A Summary of Atomic Habits. Overview. The introduction discusses the importance of small changes, systems over goals, and identity change. The core of the book covers what habits are, the four steps in their formation, cue, craving, response, reward, and how to min-max these four steps. Part 1. Small changes, systems over goals, and identity. Small changes. Your current situation is a lagging result of your habits. Often we think we need to make radical changes to improve life, but what's actually more important are the things we do daily. Daily actions are akin to compound interest. Their effect grows exponentially over time, whereas one-off large-scale changes are rare and difficult to sustain. It doesn't matter how successful or unsuccessful you are right now. What matters is whether your habits are putting you on the path to success. So takeaway number one is to increase your focus on small daily improvements and decrease it from large radical ones. Now this concept applies both to physical aspects like health and wealth, but also to intangible concepts like character and virtue. Each time you lie, you habituate yourself to lying. Each time you act cowardly, you habituate yourself to cowardice. And over time, both the results of and your propensity for these behaviors compounds. We are what we repeatedly do. Excellence, then, is not an act, but a habit. The problem we face is that small acts feel inconsequential in the moment. A single gym session or unhealthy meal won't alter your life. Atomic Habits is about how to counteract this and begin stacking these small improvements one upon another. Systems over goals. Goals are your desired outcomes, such as to lose 20 pounds. Systems are the method and processes you use to get there, what you actually do daily, such as cutting out sugar or running each morning. Goals are worth having as they orient you in a direction, but it's your systems that get you there and keep you there. In James Clear's words, you do not rise to the level of your goals, you fall to the level of your systems. So the takeaway is, to be successful, put more focus on systems and less on goals. Again, this doesn't mean have no goals, it just means your 80-20 focus should be on systems. The core advantages of systems over goals are, you can be happy and successful each day they are followed, whereas with goals, people tend to put off their happiness until after the goal is achieved, or are left unhappy should it be missed. They are persistent and lead to long-term consistency, whereas goals tend to vanish when achieved, removing the impetus to stay consistent. We tend to lose desire to keep training after achieving our weight loss or winning the race. The purpose of setting goals is to win the game. The purpose of building systems is to continue playing the game. And finally, they are more within your control. Goals tend to be outcome-dependent, and outcomes are frequently out of your control, whereas following a system is usually within your control. The goal in any sport is to finish with the best score, but it would be ridiculous to spend the whole game staring at the scoreboard. The only way to actually win is to get better each day. An action you can take to implement this concept is to take any goal you currently have and reframe it as a series of systems to get there. Your goal now becomes to follow those systems. True long-term thinking is goalless thinking. It's not about any single accomplishment. It is about the cycle of endless refinement and continuous improvement. Bad habits repeat themselves again and again, not because you don't want to change, but because you have the wrong system for change. Identity change. Permanent behavior change comes from identity change. Envision the identity you want for yourself, then be deliberate in reinforcing it by action. Identity is who you believe yourself to be and how you view the world. For example, I am a serious and committed athlete, the sort of person who trains every day, versus I am the sort of person who is no good at sport. This is not a trivial distinction. How we identify affects how we behave. For example, people who identified as being a voter were more likely to vote than those who simply claimed voting was an action they intended to perform. In this sense, identity sits superior to both goals and systems. In the long run, behaviour that is incongruent with the self will not last. The important realisation here is that you can choose who you want to become. You can choose your own identity. Once you incorporate something into your identity, you no longer have to force yourself to do it, whereas if it never becomes a part of you, you will forever need willpower to bring yourself to do it, and will eventually break the habit. In order to consciously change identity, decide who you want to be, and then prove it to yourself every day with small wins. Each time you do something in line with your new identity, you come to believe it more. Habits then are key to forming identity. They shape identity, and then identity shapes habits. It's a feedback loop. The distinction, however, is to choose habits around embodying a desired identity rather than around achieving an outcome. This is referred to as identity-based habits over outcome-based habits. The aim is not to write a book, but to become a writer, the sort of person capable of writing a book. Ultimately, getting started does still fall back on motivation and willpower, but provided the habits are aligned with your considered identity, they will stick and over time become effortless, whereas if they are unaligned and merely goal-focused, then they will always require willpower and will eventually fail. Next, consciously embody your desired identity and alter your speech to match. If you're quitting smoking and someone offers you a cigarette, say, "No thanks, I'm not a smoker," rather than, "No thanks, I'm trying to quit." Reaffirm your identity as a non-smoker, and not your identity as a smoker with the goal of quitting. Finally, it's worth mentioning, negative identities can work against you, so identify and remove them. Do not say to yourself, "I'm bad at math," or "I'm not a morning person." Identifying yourself like this crafts an unnecessary identity and can lead you to resisting actions that might benefit you. So be on the lookout for aspects of your identity that are negative and focus on letting go of them. These first three concepts, small changes, systems over goals, and conscious identity change, are quite abstract. The second part of the book deals with the more practical topic of how to actually alter habits. Part 2. Habits. You absolutely need habits to function. You cannot solve every problem in life as if it is the first time it's thrown at you. How habits form. Habits are solutions to recurring problems in your environment. The brain identifies things that make you feel better and catalogues the actions that lead up to them, rather like an if-this-then-that chain. If X occurs, then do Y to be rewarded. Note, this doesn't mean they're good or bad, simply that they solve a problem, e.g. stress. For example, you get stuck on a piece of work and feel stressed. You open a browser tab and go to YouTube. The stress is alleviated. You are rewarded. The immediate problem of stress has been solved. Notice this is not necessarily good from an objective perspective, but the negative emotion has been dispelled, so a habit begins to form. These habits form automatically over time, and we aren't necessarily aware of them as they form. The key benefit of solving recurring problems in this way is that repeat tasks are offloaded to the unconscious mind, freeing up the conscious mind. Whenever possible, the conscious mind likes to pawn off tasks to the unconscious mind to do automatically. This is precisely what happens when a habit is formed. In this regard, good habits do not restrict freedom, but create it. They free up your conscious mind and move mundane or possibly unpleasant things to the unconscious mind. Now, a core concept of the book is that habits can be broken down into four parts: the cue, the craving, the response, and the reward. The cue is what triggers you to initiate action, getting stuck on a piece of work. The craving is the motivational force behind the action, the feeling of stress that you want to alleviate. The response is your action to obtain the reward and relieve the craving, opening YouTube. and the reward is the satisfying of a craving. Stress and frustration fade, and you're entertained. Atomic Habits is about focusing in on this habit chain, amplifying it to form good habits, and disrupting it to end bad ones. In simple terms, to form a good habit, make its cue obvious, the action attractive, easy to enact, and satisfying. To break a bad habit, make its cue invisible, the action unattractive, difficult to enact, and unsatisfying. The more of these things you hit, the more successful you'll be. It's worth noting that cues have different meanings to different people. The sound of a slot machine may trigger a gambler, but have no effect on someone else. So cues only have meaning when mental links are formed. The rest of the book details both practical and conceptual methods to implement these four steps. Detailed methods on all four. Before beginning, become aware of your current habits by making a list of all the things you habitually do throughout the day. Mark them off as good, bad, or neutral, based on whether they benefit you in the long run. There's a link to the Atomic Habits scorecard below, and an example from the book on screen. First law, cues, how to make them obvious or invisible. Principle 1, pointing and calling. The aim here is to make ourselves notice good cues more often and hide bad cues away. For bad habits, a proven mechanism you can use to lessen them is to say out loud the actions you're taking and the long-term result. I'm about to eat this cookie, but I don't need to. Eating it will cause me to gain weight, impact my health, and make me less happy. This adds immediate weight to your actions and raises them from the subconscious to the conscious, asking your rational mind to make a decision on them. Likewise, saying positive things you will do aloud increases the chance you'll do them. I will now perform 5 press-ups because this makes me stronger and in the long run happier. Remember to tie this into your identity. Ask yourself, does this habit reinforce my chosen identity? Principle 2. Implementation intentions. Making a precise statement about your future action makes you more likely to do it. Most effective is to include the precise behavior, time, and location. I will behavior at time at location. I will meditate for 2 minutes at 10 a.m. in my living room. Doing this adds clarity and triggers the psychological need for consistency. Clarity should not be underestimated. Not needing to make decisions can drastically increase the chances of success. Every time you ask yourself whether you're going to bother doing something, you've basically given yourself a 50-50 chance of failure. When the moment of action occurs, there's no need to make a decision. Simply follow your predetermined plan. Many people think they lack motivation, when what they really lack is clarity. And finally, consistency is our psychological need to be consistent with our former selves. It's like a psychological flaw you can use to your benefit. Check out Robert Cialdini's 5th rule of persuasion, consistency, for more info. Principle 3. Habit stacking. Remember, a cue is just one something that triggers you to do another something. You can deliberately use the end of a mundane habit you already have as the cue to start a new habit you want to form. After I pour my coffee each morning, I will do 10 push-ups. This is effectively an implementation intention combined with habit stacking. Make sure such cues are as specific as possible. So not, when I take my break for lunch, I will do some exercise, but when I close my laptop for lunch, I will do 10 push-ups next to my desk. Principle 4. Life algorithms. You can extend this cue method to algorithms for situations in life. Whenever I walk into a party, I will introduce myself to someone I don't know in the first 60 seconds. Whenever I see a set of stairs, I will take them instead of the elevator. Whenever I want something over $100, I will wait 24 hours before buying it. Principle 5. Environment matters more than motivation. Ultimately, the most reliable solution to end a habit is to remove the cues entirely, rather than trying to resist them. and you can achieve this by changing your environment. Speaking personally, of the five principles listed under cues, this is probably the most impactful. Our habits change based on environment to a remarkable degree. An example given in the book is that during the Vietnam War, many soldiers addicted to heroin whilst on deployment completely stopped using it upon returning home, the change in environment being enough to break the addiction. But likewise, bad habits can return in a similar fashion upon re-entering old environments or even friend groups. This suggests the neural pathways to behaviours are always there deep down. The people with the best self-control are typically the ones who need to use it the least. It's easier to practice self-restraint when you don't have to use it very often. So yes, perseverance, grit, and willpower are essential to success, but the way to improve these qualities is not by wishing you were a more disciplined person, but by creating a more disciplined environment. So, be deliberate about altering the space around you. Put cues for good habits in sight, hide cues for bad ones away. If you have bad habits that are really hard to stop, leave the environment altogether and go somewhere else. It's much easier than trying to redesign everything and rewire old habits. On a very conceptual level, something suggested is to stop viewing your environment as filled with objects, but rather view it in terms of relationships. The couch is where you read each night, or where you watch TV. Your phone is a source of distractions. Your laptop is what you use to write essays, or what you use to watch YouTube. Depending on your answer, change how you treat it. Also, psychologically, it's better to have a separate room for work and for play, so separate your spaces when possible. If your space is limited, divide the room into different areas. The couch for videos, the desk for work. This means you shouldn't let yourself watch a video whilst sat at the desk. If you're really short of space, you can do it with devices. Your laptop is only for writing, your tablet is only for YouTube, your phone is only for emails or messages. Second law, craving. How to make action attractive or painful. Principle 1. Associate positive actions with rewards. Temptation bundling. When dopamine release was blocked in rats, they exhibited no desire and simply starved themselves to death. Desire is the engine that drives behavior. In later studies, sugar was squirted directly into the rats' mouths, and when this happened, they still exhibited signs of pleasure, but without dopamine, made no effort to pursue it. The conclusion is that it's the dopamine released by the anticipation of reward that motivates us to act. So deliberately associate habits you want to start doing with rewards. In a practical sense, the best way to do this is by bundling them with something you enjoy. Either following on from one another, when I take my phone out, I won't use it until I've done 10 burpees, or done at the same time. I'll only listen to entertainment podcasts when working out at the gym. In this latter case, your brain begins associating a visit to the gym with entertainment. Principle 2. Set up motivation rituals. Many athletes have pre-game rituals, allowing them to enter the right frame of mind for a game, regardless of how they feel beforehand. You can do something similar for life. A simple example would be to have a set of headphones you always put on before working, then putting them on becomes associated with working. Something else suggested is that you can set up a short ritual before something you love and use this to enter positive emotional states at will. If you love petting your dog, then taking 3 deep breaths and smiling before you pet the dog can build the association of happiness merely with 3 deep breaths and smiling. You can then use this to enter a happy mood at will. Principle 3. Join a tribe to sustain your motivation. We're tribal animals, and social norms within a tribe can influence our habits. Nothing sustains motivation better than belonging to a tribe, as the tribe's behavior tends to overpower the individuals. When changing your habits means fitting in with the tribe, change is very attractive. We also soak up the qualities and behaviors of individuals around us, so surround yourself with people who have the habits and character you want to have yourself. In general, we naturally imitate those closest to us, the wider tribe, and those who are rich or powerful. Principle 4. Deliberately reframing your associations and emotions. The obstacle becomes the way. The key to finding and fixing your bad habits is to reframe the associations you have about them. Our behavior is heavily dependent on how we interpret the events that happen to us, not necessarily the objective reality of the events themselves. We have underlying human desires, such as to achieve status, to win affection, or to reproduce, and a craving is your brain's way of making you pursue one of these. It does this by predicting an action that will achieve one of them, and then delivering an emotion to your conscious mind to motivate you to act. But frequently, the predictions can be wrong. Video games feed your desire for status, prestige, and a feeling of progress, but they're not real. Tinder feeds your desire to reproduce, but unless you seriously mess up, it doesn't really achieve that. In both cases, the subconscious prediction is entirely wrong. Sometimes the prediction can be right, but the solution still not optimal. For example, you may alleviate stress by smoking while someone else goes for a run. In each case, the important thing to realize is that we can consciously reform predictions and default reactions to better achieve what we want. To do this, consciously recognize what desire you are satiating with a particular habit and look for an alternative or superior way to satisfy it. Secondly, since emotions drive our decisions to act, reframing our emotions can alter how we act. Instead of saying to yourself you have to do something, say you get to do something. You get to go to the gym, you get to wake up early, you get to spend time with your family. Reframe these things not as burdens, but as opportunities. The obstacle becomes the way. I am not confined by my wheelchair, I am liberated by it. In the same vein, reframe your desired habits to highlight their benefits rather than their negatives. Think, it's time to build endurance and get fast, not, I have to go for a run. Think, saving money lets me become financially free, not, I need to save. When meditating, each interrupting thought gives you a chance to return to your breath, so don't resent the interruptions, they are the very things that allow you to practice meditation. Third law, response. How to make action easy or difficult. Principle 1. Reduce friction. We are wired to do what is convenient and uses the least energy, so it makes sense to optimize for this by adding or removing barriers. The fewer things that stand in the way of your desired behavior, the more often you will do it. There are three principal ways to go about this. First, design your habits to fit with your current routine. Habits that are in line with your current daily routine are easier to follow. For example, you're much more likely to use a gym that's on the way to work than one that is out of the way, even by a few blocks. This implies that you should be prepared to pay more for something that fits with your current routine, even if it is technically the inferior product. Another way to think of this is that you shouldn't design habits based on the motivation you're feeling in the moment, but rather intelligently based on maximizing the likelihood of them being followed. Next, be deliberate when designing your environment to reduce friction for good habits and increase it for bad ones. We've discussed earlier how you can modify your environment to make cues obvious or hidden. You can go further so that even if you do receive a cue, there is a barrier in the way of acting on it. Just as with cues, placing barriers in the path of bad habits is more powerful than using willpower to resist them. Doing so is referred to as a Ulysses contract or commitment device. Some examples of this in action are to stop eating sugar, remove sugary products from the house rather than trying to resist them. This forces you to leave the house should you want to eat them. Deleting accounts rather than trying to avoid signing in. This forces you to recreate the account should you want to use the site. Installing social media blockers or feed blockers, forcing you to disable them should you want to engage. Opting in to automatic saving plans rather than needing to actively save. Setting out workout clothes and a water bottle so you're ready to go in the morning. Chopping up vegetables and preparing healthy foods in containers ahead of time so you have easy access to healthy ready-to-eat options. or unplugging the TV, so there's a hurdle to using it, only plugging it in if you can say out loud what you want to watch. In each of these cases, you're taking a single action now to prevent multiple recurring actions in the future. You're effectively leveraging your willpower. Finally, make a habit of resetting environments whenever you leave them, not only to stay on top of cleaning, but also to prepare them for the next time you need to use them. If you were a writer, an example of this might be writing the first few lines of the next chapter before finishing for the day, giving future you an easy point to start writing from tomorrow. Principle 2. Identify and habituate decisive moments. There are decisive moments each day that are like a fork in the road, either sending you in the direction of a productive day or an unproductive one. For example, when working from home, it's easy to get distracted. A decisive moment might come each morning when you make a decision between heading out to a co-working space or staying at home. Choosing to head out might alleviate all the distractions of working from home. Again, one small act of willpower, removing the need for many future ones. It's like a habit pressure point. So, make a habit of recognizing and calling out these moments to yourself when you see them. Find and acknowledge the key decisions you're making. Then, focus on habituating the action of choosing the right path at these pressure points, so you consistently get set on course for a good day. Doing so is many times more effective than focusing on habituating individual tasks. Principle 3. The most effective form of learning is practice. As a rule of thumb, action is better than planning, and experimentation is better than theory. Making a sales call is action, doing market research is planning. Sometimes planning is necessary, but frequently it becomes a form of procrastination. So, make it a principle to take action quickly, then perfect by iterations. The point is to master the habit of showing up. Applied to habits, this means beginning them immediately and refining them over time, rather than attempting to plan them out perfectly from the outset. Don't try to engineer the perfect habit from the start. Do the easy thing on a more consistent basis. An example given in the book is that Professor Jerry Oldsman at the University of Florida split his class into two groups. The first would be graded on their single best photograph, the second on the quantity they produced. The result was that all the best photographs came from the quantity group, as they experimented more freely, whereas the perfection group became bogged down. As you master this art of showing up, the first 2 minutes begin to become a ritual for the beginning of a larger routine. This ritualizing can help you slip into a state of deep focus, which is required if you want to achieve great things. This leads to Principle 4, the 2-minute rule. To master showing up, make new habits as easy as possible to start. Have them take less than 2 minutes. A few press-ups, or just putting on your gym kit but not going to the gym. If it feels false, prove to yourself it's not by just stopping after 2 minutes. The point is to begin building the habit of showing up, which is 90% of the struggle. Once you're showing up consistently, the full habit begins to form. Then you can work on expanding and improving it. For larger habits, you can choose to break them up into stages. For example, getting up at 6 a.m, the first phase could be to be home by 10 p.m, phase 2, to turn off all devices by 10, phase 3, to be in bed by 10, phase 4, to have lights off by 10, and phase 5, to get up at 6 a.m. The fourth law, reward, how to make habits enjoyable or painful. When an experience is pleasurable, we're more likely to repeat it. But to feel pleasurable, the reward needs to be immediate. It cannot be delayed. Principle 1. Rewards. Make avoiding bad habits or completing good habits rewarding. Example, if you're trying to avoid wasting money at Starbucks, then when you avoid purchasing a drink, add the money immediately to a savings account so you can see your progress. Referring back to 2.4 and reframing associations, you don't have to avoid it, but you get to add money to your savings account. But make sure the reward is something beneficial and not itself another bad habit. For example, you get to go for a massage, not eat a tub of Ben & Jerry's. Principle 2. Habit tracking. Habit tracking highlights small wins, which is addictive as we like to see progress. You can do this via apps, physical tick boxes, or visual markers like transferring marbles from one jar to another. Make sure to track it immediately after completion when possible, and not to batch it at the end of the day. Doing so gives you an immediate psychological reward. Automate it when possible, otherwise you have created an administrative task. A powerful mantra to keep in mind is, don't break the chain. But you will eventually break it. The problem is not slipping up, the problem is thinking one slip up means it's not worth doing it anymore. So a second mantra, never miss twice, is useful. Too often we fall into an all-or-nothing cycle with our habits. The problem is not slipping up, the problem is thinking that if you can't do something perfectly, then you shouldn't do it at all. Be careful not to start pursuing the metric rather than the improvement. For example, how many times you go to the gym versus actually getting fitter. When a measure becomes a target, it ceases to be a good measure. Principle 3. Accountability partners. Bad habits usually give us immediate rewards at the expense of long-term pain. Making the pain immediate can correct this. One way to do this is to have someone hold you accountable. Write out a habit contract, what you're committing to, and what the penalty is if you fail. This is necessary because most other people are busy with their own lives, and if you just casually mention your commitment, they are unlikely to hold you accountable. And if there aren't any penalties, what does accountability even mean? Stick.com is a brilliant website for putting this into practice. If you don't possess any friends, you can also crowdsource accountability. Schedule a tweet for 6 a.m. that you need to get up and cancel each morning. If you fail, it goes out. It's 6 a.m. and I'm not out of bed. I'm not out of bed because I'm lazy. The first 3 people to reply to this tweet will receive $10 each by PayPal. Having this go out will be painful. Finally, I would add myself to never boast about your plans to anyone unless you know they are going to hold you accountable. Doing so gives you the feeling of accomplishment early on without actually accomplishing anything, resulting in you actually losing motivation. Work hard in silence. Let your success be your noise. Principle 4. Make it compatible with your personality and genetics. Habits are easier when aligned with your genetic dispositions. Don't force yourself to do things you're not suited for if it's not working. Our genes do not eliminate the need for hard work, they clarify it. They tell us what to work hard on. Pick the right habit and progress is easy. Pick the wrong habit and life is a struggle. To find what you're suited for, ask yourself, what feels like fun to me but work to others? When have I felt authentic and genuine? What makes me lose track of time? Flow states, that is when you become engrossed in your work, lose track of time and achieve absolute focus, tends to occur when you're operating right on the edge of your competency. It's more productive to focus on whether you are fulfilling your own potential than comparing yourself to someone else. When the habits you're building are going well, exploit, exploit, exploit. Heighten and do more of them. But when you're struggling, explore, explore, explore. Search around for new things and experiment. It could be you're doing the wrong things. A rule of thumb is to spend 80 to 90% of your time on exploiting and 10 to 20% on exploration. One of the secrets to maximizing your odds of success is to choose the right field of competition. And if there's not a pre-existing field of competition that suits you well, you can fashion one. If you can't find a game where the odds are stacked in your favor, create one. You can create your own niche by combining the things you're good at. The more you do this, the more you'll excel at it compared to other people. If you're in the top 25% for drawing, you won't make much as an artist. If you're in the top 25% for drawing and comedy, you'll do okay as a comic artist. If you're in the top 25% for drawing, comedy, and you have a business background, then perhaps you'll thrive as a comic artist who writes about office life. Closing points. The closing points of Atomic Habits highlights that no habit will stay interesting forever. You need to learn to love boredom if you're seeking mastery in anything. There will always be days you feel like quitting. We get bored with habits because they stop delighting us. The outcome becomes expected. And as our habits become ordinary, we start derailing our progress to seek novelty. Men desire novelty to such an extent that those who are doing well wish for a change just as much as those who are doing badly. Finally, a good mantra for yourself is, anyone can work hard when they feel motivated. It's the ability to keep working when work isn't exciting that makes the difference. At some point, everyone faces the same challenge on the journey of self-improvement. You have to fall in love with boredom. The upside to habits is that you can do things without thinking. The downside is that we can stop paying attention to feedback and accept little errors so long as things are good enough. For mundane activities like getting dressed, cleaning your home, etc., this is fine. But for mastery in something, you need a combination of habits and deliberate practice. So establish a system for reflection and review of your performance. Some questions you could ask yourself: what went well? What didn't go so well? What did I learn? But remember, this doesn't need to be extensive or too frequent. There is always a balance to be found. Finally, be wary of being held back by your own habits. Initially, habits help you form an identity for yourself, but be aware that it's possible to start ignoring weak spots so as to avoid criticism and defend this new identity. Try to avoid making any one identity all-important. Your identity can change suddenly if you lose your job or sell your business. This can lead to identity loss. The key to maintaining your identity in such situations is to reframe it. I'm an athlete becomes, I'm the type of person who is mentally tough and enjoys a challenge. I'm a soldier becomes, I'm the type of person who is disciplined and reliable on a team. I'm a CEO becomes, I'm the type of person who builds and creates things. Reframing like this allows you to continue to operate as the same sort of person, only in a new environment. This has been a summary of Atomic Habits. If you'd like to find out more about the app I'm creating focused on implementing its suggestions, then you can sign up to the beta tester mailing list by following this link.